Welcome to Audio Notes. I'm Nikki Sweat, your host for the 2022 Music at Menlo season. This year's festival, Haydn Connections, is a celebration of Joseph Haydn and how the impact of his music can be heard to this day. The first concert of the season, on Saturday, July 16th, explores some of the musical traditions that Haydn emerged from. We'll hear two cantatas, Haydn's innovative and operatic Ariana Anaxos for soprano and ensemble, and J.S. Bach's humorous but intermittently sublime Coffee Cantata. And we'll also hear two concertos, the early C major violin concerto by Haydn, and the very first number on this concert program, the 1753 cello concerto in A major by Haydn's contemporary Carl Philipp Emanuel Bach. C.P.E. Bach, like Haydn early on in his career, wrote music that is hard to put in a stylistic box. It can sound Baroque, it can sound classical, but often it exhibits a voice that doesn't quite fall into either category. The cellist Inbal Segev, who will play the solo on this piece, explains what Emanuel Bach borrows from earlier music and what is so distinctive about his writing in this concerto.
The style is really a bridge between his father, JSB, and what's to come, Haydn, Mozart. And so while the outer movements are in Galland style, the middle movement is the sentimental style. And so I think of CPE more of Haydn, like a Haydn-esque feeling rather than Baroque, late Baroque. Just those jagged interruptions. Well, in the first movement, you know, it's interesting how the concerto was still very much in early stages of its being. So if you compare to Vivaldi concertos, and this is a generalization, but there was more a call and response, meaning there would be like a short melody, the orchestra would play, and then the soloist would answer with another short melody or not so short, and then it would come back to the tutti. And here you really see a conversation. I like to laugh, joke, like it's in my family, we interrupt each other constantly. So it's like C.P.E. Bach's writing. So basically there is a tutti or an opening with the orchestra, but then once the cello solo comes in, it's a constant back and forth. We just the first entrance, dum, bididum, 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 bum, bum, bum. The orchestra comes in with that forte while we are sort of effervescent and gallant. We finish the ensemble sentences and they finish ours, and it's very much integrated. I think the second movement is really the most beautiful thing ever. It's the heart of the piece. We hear, you know, right at the beginning, the cello is coming in with the highest register. While we hear first the violins in their lowest register, so that's an interesting approach. he really quotes his father's Symphonia number 9 in F minor, BWV 795. So if you listen to that, it's the same melody, just exactly the same melody. Of course, he changes the feel, and that was written for keyboard. And here we have this beautiful, you know, string instrument with our voice effects like vibrato we can add. I think more of Haydn in the last movement, where those triplets in the ritornello suddenly change, and suddenly you hear this more melodic line, and then the cello comes in with the eighths that are more kind of square and less fleeting than the triplets, and is staking its ground. I think that effervescent and gallant style wins in the end. When we come in, the cello soloists are not in triplets, we're in eighths, we're in dotted rhythm, and there is pride. Then it goes back and forth. So little by little, we actually borrow some of those triplets and we become part of the team. And then there's a very long rant, if you will, around bar 156. And it's a virtuosic passage of us playing the triplets. We end the movement with those sweeping triplets and light, a virtuosic and elegant style.
In 1789, Joseph Haydn was well established in Vienna as a composer, secure in his patronage, and comfortable experimenting. That year, he wrote a dramatically rich solo cantata, told from the perspective of Ariadne from Greek mythology, as she reflects on her love of Theseus and comes to realize that he has abandoned her on the island of Naxos. Ariana on Naxos was published the next year and quickly became one of his most popular works. The mezzo-soprano, Sasha Cook, told me about what makes this piece so successful and unique, and how Haydn builds on the operatic methods that Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart had been developing in the preceding years.
There is no doubt that Haydn took a lot of inspiration from Mozart and vice versa. I think they were great admirers of each other. There is certainly an operatic quality. I would call this the most operatic thing I know that Haydn ever wrote. I don't think there's anything else like it in his repertory. And I actually don't think there's like anything like this in Mozart's repertory, because of course the original composition was for forte piano and voice, and it was really revolutionary. To me, it's more of an ensemble piece than maybe a Mozart aria, where the voice is really set up like a different instrument in this piece, I find the two are totally equal partners, and there's a lot of soloistic material in the accompaniment. This opening is exquisite. Just that in itself is enough reason to enjoy the piece. Then there's stillness. So after this fabulous opening, she's barely making a sound. She creeps into the musical atmosphere very quietly, simply unaccompanied, more to the effect of her waking up. So the way I imagine the beginning, A, she's waking up. It's a beautiful scene. So we're outside, right? We know that she's on the island of Naxos. He's not there. Theseus isn't there, but the memory of him is. And I think that there's just this very sweet, calming setting. It also sets the audience up for surprise, which of course is a very Haydnian thing. He does switch at the last moment in the first aria to minor, and you wonder, why is this sudden change of feeling? And I think it's because for a moment, she realizes that it's scary to love someone that much. And what if he's not there? What if he's not coming? So Haydn's foreshadowing in a bit, but it only happens at the end. And I don't think of it so much as pain in the text, but longing. You know, when we know someone has touched us deeply, it hurts a little bit. So she's suddenly waking up. She's suddenly there in the space and actually contemplating, well, where is he? You know, so she goes to search. And spots him with the Greeks leaving. But it's a slow burn. So she calls out for him. She questions if maybe she's seeing a vision, and then she realizes she's been abandoned. It's just fast, furious, exciting, dynamic, all the things that Haydn can do so wonderfully. I think it's a mad scene, but in the end she wins. So he's going to make sure that we leave her on a strong note. She is not a woman that has been wronged. She is a woman with vengeance in her heart. She's strong. When I play her, that's how I feel about it. And I think as a modern woman myself, I don't think, oh, weak Ariana, left by the guy, what's left to her life, you know? So I think Haydn does similarly.
We hear a more youthful Haydn in the third number on this program, his violin concerto in C major. Like the work of C.P.E. Bach that opens the concert, it's a piece that explores new ways of pitting a soloist against an ensemble, but it displays perhaps even more tendencies that would become key features of concertos from the classical and romantic eras. Violinist Jennifer Frauci discusses the challenges and the fun of this piece.
Haydn wrote his C major violin concerto sometime in the 1760s, and we don't know exactly when, but some people think it was around 1761. And in his own catalog, he inscribed that this piece was written for Luigi, and he was referring to Luigi Tomasini, who was a notable musician of the time, Italian, and was in the first violins of the Esterhazy Court Orchestra, where Haydn was, at that time, I believe, vice Kapellmeister, and later became Kapellmeister. And Tomasini was such a brilliant violinist that he eventually became the concertmaster. So this was really written with him in mind. Writing in this concerto is of a particular kind of virtuosity, which I think recalls a more Vivaldi-esque Italianate type writing. The first movement of the Haydn concerto is pointing towards sonata form, which is the standard form that, you know, Mozart and basically everyone who came after him used for the first movement of violin concerti. But it doesn't really follow the standard expectations of sonata form, which is to say that the orchestra starts with opening thematic material. Violin responds with, you know, that same material. He does have what I call an extended development. He reintroduces the opening idea, the opening theme, and then he goes into this extended minor section, and where we have this triplet figuration. ¶¶ We end up in A minor, which is the relative minor of C major. And then he comes back to the opening theme again, this time back in C major, but immediately goes to C minor. Goes into, you know, another kind of extended, what I call Vivaldi-esque riff, and then leads us into a cadenza. And that's what really also is one of the things that points forward to Mozart and beyond, is this expectation or convention that you have at the end of your first movement, an extended improvisation. In Vivaldi's concerti, you might have a little bit of improvisation leading from the middle movement into the last movement, but this is really a full-blown cadenza at the end of the first movement. Yeah, the second movement of Haydn is really a remarkable piece, and I almost feel like it could stand alone as its own aria, basically. But it's also written in a really interesting fashion that's, to me, quite rare, which is to say it's bookended, the beginning and the end, by basically like a prologue and an epilogue, very short. But it's like a narrator comes out and sets up the scene and then at the end closes out the scene by saying, and now there's a happy ending. But it's really, the violin has a three-bar figure that's just an ascending scale, basically. It's very simple. Then when the actual body of this amazing long aria begins, the strings switch to pizzicato and they're strumming for the entire movement until the very, very end. It's a very pure and lovely melody, and this to me sounds like it could go either way, like a young woman before her wedding night, you know, singing about, you know, what's to come with great tenderness and expectation. There's, you know, there's some minor sections, there's some turns to like, oh, what if this happens, what if that happens, but it's basically in this very loving and lovely place. But I think it's maybe more appropriate to think of it as a young man serenading his loved one with this, you know, beautiful strumming accompaniment. And there's this little prologue. Again, the violin has an ascending scale, basically, that closes out the movement. And I feel like that's, again, like it's very theatrical to me. It's like the narrator coming, or like the Greek chorus coming and saying, and that's what happened, and now we're going to move on to the, you know, next phase in our story. Thank you. the third movement of the Haydn is, it's marked presto, it's really rollicking, it's very exciting. Again, like the first movement, there's, you know, back and forth exchange between the orchestra and the violinist. And each time the violin takes the material that the orchestra has introduced, the violin part is embellished. It's not just a straight repetition. He adds on the double stops. The fact that in every section, he introduces a different technical challenge, I think, keeps it very fresh and interesting.
I drink a lot of coffee.
I'm a huge coffee nut. It's my one downfall, probably.
I basically drink 2 to 3 espressos a day. Most of the time they are decaf, but because I love the aroma and the ritual of drinking coffee.
I love coffee. I can't wait to play the coffee cantata.
I also love coffee. I have an espresso every morning and also one after lunch. J.S. Bach wrote his famous coffee cantata in the 1730s while in Leipzig. He directed a group that performed regularly at Zimmermann's Coffee House, and this piece shows evidence that it was meant for a relatively casual performance there. The tenor Nick Pahn explained that coffee was a controversial topic at that time, and he took me through the story that Bach tells us.
He was, at the time, actually in charge of this music series that was performing at a coffee shop, Zimmermann's Coffee House in Leipzig. And this was probably premiered there in that space for that audience, quote unquote. You know, at the time, I think women were even prohibited from going to coffee houses because there was this big debate about whether it was moral to drink coffee or not in German society. And so it was kind of a hot topic at the time. It was really popular. And I think the patriarchy found that kind of threatening, so they had to moralize about it. What I kind of love about the beginning of this cantata is that the narrator, who is me, the tenor, which is, it's very common for Bach to sort of use a tenor voice as a narrator. The first thing that happens is there's a chord and the tenor comes out and tells everybody to shut up. I think this is where you get the sense that this piece was intended for a coffee house. I mean, I just sort of picture it in some sort of place where people are chatting and talking and suddenly everybody needs to quiet down. And so somebody sort of claps their hands and says, hey, pay attention, I'm going to tell you a story. And so the first person we're introduced to is Schlendrian, this dad, his name even translates into something like grumpy loser or something like this. And the narrator introduces us to this father who's grumbling about how his daughter won't listen to him. It's funny, the first aria is not really that beautiful a piece of music. It's not very melodic. Schlendrian's lines are basically low D naturals that repeat themselves. And then suddenly he'll jump up a fourth or a fifth occasionally, which those are not very elegant intervals. There's not really much that's melodic about it. And when the violin sort of introduces theme, they kind of have this sort of, they play those repeated D naturals, but they sort of embellish it with these lower neighbors that kind of just make it seem like it's a grating, irritable person who's just kind of grumbling. Well, they have a little recitative, and he says, "You got to listen to me," and she doesn't, and instead she just declares her love for coffee. It's amazing. She sings this beautiful aria that happens right afterwards, where the flute is introduced for the first time. And it's kind of this beautiful chamber moment where she sings this sort of little dancey minuet with the flute. What's kind of nice about it is that the flute sort of sounds like the coffee a little bit. The writing for the flute sounds a little bit like a very happy boiling pot of water. And you can kind of picture a little steam coming out of a little spout, and it's like a musical depiction of a little teapot, or coffee pot in this case. And he tries in the next recitative to scare her away from her addiction of coffee. It's sort of this kind of bizarre intervention moment where it's like, if you don't give it up, I'm gonna, you know, lock you away, as if he's gonna like lock her away in some sort of rehab facility where she can't see anybody, and she'll never get a new dress, and she won't get pretty bows for her hair. And he sort of just tries to take away any sort of bribe or embellishment in her life. And she seems pretty unfazed and unthreatened by that. He sort of turns away in his next aria. That aria, it's interesting. Suddenly the orchestra disappears. It's just the continuo accompanying him. So it's actually quite this private moment for him, musically speaking. You know, he doesn't really have anybody else in the room with him. It's the first time that you see in Schlendrian's writing a little bit of wit. You know, he has some melismas at the end, and they're all sort of rising scales, and it kind of communicates this sense that he thinks he's found the right strategy. Well, his strategy again is to threaten her and say, you know, if she gives up coffee, he'll give her a husband. She replies, "Oh, that's great. I can do that. If that's the reward, then, you know, that's definitely worth doing." And she then sings this epic, long, beautiful aria in G major that's got the full orchestra accompanying her again. So it seems like she agrees to his deal. The narrator tells us that she goes around town and she says, no man should approach my father to ask to marry me unless he agrees that I can make coffee whenever I want, which, I mean, she said earlier was at least 3 times a day, but she wants even more freedom than that. And she does this sort of behind her dad's back, and that's how she sort of outsmarts him. You can try and change people, but ultimately you're going to fail. I mean, that to me seems like the moral of the story here. And that's kind of how the chorus sort of goes at the end. It's sort of like, this is our nature, and so why bother fighting that? It sounds to me like he doesn't think coffee's so threatening at the end of the day.
Audio notes are written and produced by Nikki Sweat in consultation with David Finkel and Wu Han. Many thanks to Inbal Segev, Sasha Cook, Jennifer Frouchy, and Nick Pan for speaking with me on this session. Audio excerpts are courtesy of the following artists and organizations: C.P.E. Bach's Concerto in A Major for Cello and Strings, W172, was played by Andreas Brantelid, Nelson Lee, Meg Freivogel, Liz Freivogel, Daniel McDonough, Kurt Marocki, and Gabriel Schuford. Joseph Haydn's Ariana Anaxos for Contralto and String Quintet was performed by Eva Pottles, Annie Kavafian, Aaron Keefe, Paul Neubauer, Julie Albers, Kurt Marocki, and Kenneth Cooper, and can be heard on the Chamber Music Society of Lincoln Center's album Dreams of Fancy, Tales of Loss. The recording of Haydn's violin concerto in C major was provided courtesy of violin soloist Ivan Chan, heard with the Concerto Soloists of Philadelphia. And Johann Sebastian Bach's Coffee Cantata, BWV 211, was performed by Sari Gruber, John Aller, Christopheren Nomura, Carol Wincens, Joseph Silverstein, Lily Francis, Beth Guterman, Priscilla Lee, Dashun Zhang, and Kenneth Cooper. Audio notes are a copyrighted production of Music at Menlo.